If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with the New York State Certified Seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, Heritage Radio listeners, and welcome to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. I am extremely excited to quickly share that finally my restaurant, Samisa, is open in Williamsburg. Yes, it's true. Our brick-and-mortar location is open for real. 7 days a week, 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. As a special treat for Heritage Radio listeners, if you come in and say you are a Heritage Radio contributor, we'll give you 10% off your first meal. Of course, it's on the honor system, so if you like what you hear on Heritage Radio, please go to Heritage Radio Network.org, and then a top right hand corner where it says show some love, go ahead and help us keep delivering all this amazing content that helps get you through your day. Okay, now on to the really fun stuff, because I have an incredible guest with me today who's got a unbelievable trajectory that we're going to talk all about. Sheena Otto is the head baker at Il Buco Alimentari. She also bakes all the bread for Il Buco. She was born and raised in New York City's Hell Kitchen and has taken a winding road in order to land at her current job. I want this story to unfold, so listeners, I'm going to ditch the bio on this episode, and we're going to work our way through Sheena's journey as she sort of tells it to us. I feel like I'm along for the ride, too, because when I read your bio, I thought, this is unbelievable. I wasn't even sure if this is real, that someone has had this many different variety of jobs. So let's start immediately with the one that kind of jumped out at me. You previously were an investigator in the New York Police Department.
Actually, I was as a civilian investigator.
Okay.
There's a city agency called the Civilian Complaint Review Board, and it's like the watchdog agency for the NYPD.
And what does that even consist of, a watchdog agency?
It's instead of having, well, you have internal affairs, which is police officers, you know, battling corruption of other police officers. As a having a civilian watchdog agency, it's sort of gives like another check and balance to, you know, overseeing the police department. So we don't, like the Civilian Complaint Review Board or, you know, the CCRB does not deal with some of the things that Internal Affairs deals with. We would investigate allegations of excessive force, you know, including and up to like wrongful death by shooting, all the way down to discourteous language or offensive language. Whereas internal affairs would deal more with corruption issues.
Are you an employee of the city of New York?
Yes.
Or okay, yeah. So it's a governmental organization to a certain extent?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And is it fall under the purview of the DA's office, or is it totally separate from any like legal organization?
It's a little unclear. It's a civilian agency. They only recently got the power to prosecute the cases that they, where they substantiate misconduct. But prior to that, when I was working there, we would hand over our findings to the NYPD, and then it was up to the NYPD itself to hand out discipline to the officers. So they could either discipline the officer or literally do nothing. So that they just recently got power to prosecute is kind of a big deal. But it's not really, the DA deals more with criminals, like a criminal complaint. Whereas, like, obviously, you know, cursing at someone on the street is, you know, not nice, but it's not, you know, you wouldn't go to jail for it.
How did you end up in what sounds like an incredibly stressful job that is... Did it cause some animosity? I mean, you are, in essence, part of internal affairs. You are investigating or you're a watchdog agency over police officers. Obviously, there's got to be some conflict there. They must know you and you must know them to a certain extent, right?
Well, you would think that, but honestly, there I never really encountered any kind of real animosity where I was afraid. I mean, there are 40,000, you know, police officers in the city. And, you know, although, you know, no one likes coming down, you know, to the CCRB because they had a complaint lodged against them. It's just, it's, I found that it's not worth it to them or their jobs to, you know, really express that kind of animosity. It's just another, you know, it's just an investigation. It's just part of the job. For them. I mean, I'm not sure if that's what you were.
Yeah. How did you end up at the CCRB?
I applied. When I was in high school, I assumed that I would just become, you know, my trajectory was going to be, you know, I wanted to be a district attorney. Mm-hmm. So I took all the criminal justice classes and all that. And then, when I was, I met a lawyer who advised me to work at a law firm for at least a year before I decided to, you know, dump a lot of money into law school. And I did. I was a paralegal for 2 years, and I was like, I do not want to be an attorney mm-hmm. at all. But when I was in college, I had interned at the public defender's office in D.C. as an investigator. So for the summer, I would go out and interview, witnesses to the cases that my defense attorney was working on and like canvas a scene. And it was work that I really enjoyed. So when I started looking for a new job after being a paralegal, I saw the job listing for the CCRB, and it's, you know, it's a city agency. So I applied and I talked about my previous, you know, summer internship. And I mean,
what spoke to you the most about that job?
I guess as a native New Yorker, I was just, you know, I always am interested in like giving back to the community and just seeing like, you know, what we can do, you know, what I can do to, you know, help everyone around me. And when I had applied to the CCRB, the agency had just received a huge infusion of money from the city budget because of the whole Amadou Diallo and a couple of other cases that had happened. So Giuliani was under a lot of pressure to like kind of regulate the police officers. At least this is how I understand it. Mm-hmm. So they had new money and they could hire some extra investigators. And I still was on a quest for justice, you know, just the same way that I wanted to become a district attorney. So I thought that, you know, this job would be a good way to do that.
So currently, in the United States right now, there seems to be a huge amount of violent incidents that are occurring. This is many years ago. You're right. Obviously not doing this anymore. Does it bring back any memories to your old job when you see the huge amount, it seems to be, of highly publicized shootings of innocent, primarily men, but innocent people all around the United States? It seems like you cannot go a single day without this happening. And I am not laying specific blame. I'm simply just stating that as a fact that is occurring. How does that impact you as someone who used to work in this field?
Well, let's see. I was with the CCRB for 6 years, so it's hard not to think back to, you know, like the patrol guide and like what, you know, the officers of this city are, you know, when they are, you know, allowed to use deadly force and when they're not. So, I mean, it's something that I have been following. Obviously, you know, I'm only seeing these stories on the news along with everyone else, but mm-hmm. There are definitely some instances where it's like,
Yeah. Surely seems to be some instances where the force was highly aggressive and yeah. The video seems to show
yeah.
that. You mentioned that you're a native New Yorker,
yes.
and that part of the thing that brought you to the job was that you are born and raised in Hell's Kitchen, right?
Correct.
Cool. So tell me a little bit about what New York was like growing up in Hell's Kitchen. I feel like now Hell's Kitchen has sort of a sexy type of vibe. It's still a little bit uncharted, but it's definitely friendly to tourists now. Was it always like that?
No. when I was a kid, it was, you know, you didn't really call it Hell's Kitchen because that was like, oh, gangs, you know.
You called it Hell.
No. They tried to rename it Clinton after DeWitt Clinton. And so that, you know, to try to give it a more friendly vibe. But everyone, you know, it was still Hell's Kitchen. And then all of a sudden, I guess after maybe mid-90s, it was cool to call it Hell's Kitchen again. But growing up, you'd be like, oh, I live in Clinton. You know, it's midtown, you know, whatever. No.
Did you live with your parents?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I grew up with my mom, single mom, and my brother, and my grandmother also.
And so where did you go to high school?
Actually, my mom was a reporter. So we lived in Manhattan until I was about 11, and she got a job at the Bridgeport Post, which is now defunct, but she made the reverse commute for about a year, and then...
Where's Bridgeport?
It's Connecticut? In Connecticut, yeah. Okay. So at that time, I was, you know, coming into... I was about to leave, you know, elementary school, entering junior high, and the schools that we were zoned for in Hell's Kitchen were not, you know, friendly schools. I mean... You know, we're talking about, like, daily beatings, probably. I'm kind of delicate, you know. So we moved out to Connecticut for 2 years, and then Trumbull, Connecticut. And then actually in high school, she got a job with Newsday, Long Island Newsday. So I went to school out in Smithtown, high school.
So before we went on the air, you mentioned, I think, actually earlier that you wanted to be a DA.
Right.
Did you go to law school right out of college? Did you start pursuing that career?
I started pursuing it. I did not go to law school. I took the LSATs and all that. I pursued it by my first job. My first two jobs out of college were at law firms, and I was a paralegal to sort of... taking the advice of the lawyer that I worked for when I was interning in DC, she said to, before I drop $100,000 on law school, to, you know, try to work in a law firm for a little bit. So I did not go to law school, although I did start to take those steps. But then when it came time to apply, I kind of, I decided against it.
So then at this point, so you've done the investigating, you've worked as a paralegal. Was there a part of your life as well where you worked at a hedge fund?
Yes.
Okay. Now let's talk about this portion of your pre-baking career. So just kind of frame it for the listeners. What year is it? And you've moved back from DC.
Right.
And you're in New York again and you're working for a hedge fund?
Let's see. I was in school in Annapolis at St. John's College, and then I was at the law. I came after college. I came right back home to Manhattan. Mm-hmm. So I worked in two New York law firms.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then that's when I worked for the CCRB for like 6 years. And then I left it around 2007. But while I was at the CCRB, which is a tough job, you know, so to sort of boost morale, that's when I really started baking at home.
Okay.
You know, and I would just bring in like treats and everything, and we all, you know, ate our feelings and. you know, trying to cope as best we could. Yeah.
Rough days with brownies at the end of the day to make everybody feel good.
Yeah. And then I decided to move to a hedge fund because I was like, you know, I love baking. Like, I love it. And I didn't want to pursue I knew I didn't want to be, you know, a lawyer anymore. And now I was like, I didn't want to go to law school anymore. And, you know, what am I going to do? And I really didn't want to stay working for the city for much longer. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I should open a bakery. So I thought, well, I need money, so I will go work at a hedge fund.
I like that you just seem to decide what you want to do. You just say, I'm going to choose the hardest jobs that I possibly can. And then you go out and then you just work at these unbelievably hard jobs. Like, paralegal is not an easy job. Hedge fund is not an easy job. How do you acquire the job at the hedge fund? What were you doing there? And how long did you end up working there for?
Well, that was about early 2007.
Okay.
So everyone was rolling in money. When I started, I told them, you know, I was like, I'll start at the bottom. I'll do whatever. I'll get your coffee. It's fine. I want to, you know, work up to being an analyst or, you know, a trader on the floor or whatever. You know, I just want to get in there. So that's pretty much how I started, you know, as an assistant. And then... you know, reading like financial reports, and it's, you know, it was a very small hedge fund. You know, the summer of 2007 was when everything peaked, and then it sort of started to fall off after that. And then, you know, in 2008, like, you know, end of, you know, 2007, early 2008, everything, you know, obviously the housing bubble
bust. The housing
bust.
Market, yeah.
Yeah, so that was probably not my best decision, looking back.
So what happens in 2008 when you're at the hedge fund and sort of the floor falls out underneath from all of the United States and you're... a new member of this hedge fund. What happens?
Well, I mean, I got laid off, you know, like so many other people did. And it was a pretty hard time. But, you know, I was able to make some money at the hedge fund. But as soon as, you know, as soon as I saw the numbers starting to fall off, like as, you know, as you're like reading all these reports, I just started like saving every single penny that I had because everyone was predicting like the doomsday, the apocalypse is coming, the market's going to fall below 5,000. And I mean, I literally, even though at the time, like maybe it seemed a little extreme to people around me, but I took zero trips. I like, you know, ate noodles and, you know, ramen and the cheapest things, but I saved every penny I could because I was, you know, I knew it was coming. And
did people around you, were they in denial or did most people know that it was coming, but they didn't want to change their lifestyle? Because you're at a hedge fund, you're making good money, and perhaps a lot of people got very accustomed to their style of living and didn't want to see the red flags that were ahead of them. Honestly, my knowledge of this subject extends to the movie The Big Short, so I pretty much have no idea what I'm talking about. But so you seem to have seen that it was coming and you sort of hunkered down.
Yeah.
Were other people around you feeling the same sort of crunch, or was everyone in denial a little bit?
There was both. The most vivid moment for me was probably I was in the little kitchen. You know, I needed a break from the phones and just from like the free fall that the market was taking. So I went into the little kitchen. It was a shared office space. So I went to the kitchen and I was making some tea. And one of the traders from an adjoining hedge fund, a much larger one, came in and he vomited in the sink. And I was just like, that is probably the day that I started eating ramen noodles. But other people were like, well, you know, if we, you know, no pun intended, hedge our bets. And but there are definitely people who are starting to become a lot more conservative.
So it sounds like a tremendously stressful situation from all levels. Your job, the whole United States is worried about what's going on. Are you baking at this point in your home? And are you doing it just as like a stress reliever?
Yeah.
Or what exactly is happening outside the office for you?
I was still baking the whole time, and I tried to bring some stuff into work, but, you know, my boss only ate egg white omelets, and he was very, like, he's like, get those cookies away from me. And I was like, oh, well, this is terrible. So, I mean, I was definitely still baking, but now I was just giving it to my neighbors and, you know, stuff like that. But it was, so I was baking the whole time.
And so I want to jump way, way back to early childhood.
Okay.
This love of baking. Where does it come from?
Let's see. There really aren't any like dedicated bakers in my family, but Thanksgiving was always a time where the entire family would kind of come together to prepare the entire meal together. And my family's from Puerto Rico, and we make this thing called pasteles, which is like a tamale, but it's, instead of having a corn base, it's got like a plantain and banana and potato base, and it's got like meat inside, but it's a 3-day process. So I think my love for cooking started then, but then, you know, they would put someone in charge of like, you know, a dessert or something. And baking to me was always a little easier than cooking. So it probably started around then.
Can you tell me about this 3-day process? I want to hear about how this happens. This sounds super cool. I haven't heard of this before. It's wrapped. Is it wrapped in a corn husk in the same way that a tamale is?
No, it's wrapped in a banana leaf for flavor, but you would also, because the banana leaf doesn't really hold it, like traditionally it's wrapped in a banana leaf, but for extra insurance, you wrap it in like a parchment paper and then you tie it with string. So
how does it start off? You make a mix. Why is it 3 days?
Okay. Well,
why can't you do it in one day?
You can, we got it down to 2 days eventually, but that's cause we use a food processor now. But when my mom was a kid, she would tell us horror stories about how you would have to grate all the potatoes on like a box grater. But, so you make the masa or like the dough, which is, it's a paste made of, brought my notes. it's raw plantains, green bananas, and yautía, which is taro, and you grind them all up together raw, and then you let them like marinate overnight. So that's day one, And then at the same time, you make the relleno, which is the filling for the pastelle, and it's made of pork and beef, chickpeas, and also a sofrito, which is made with, it goes with the filling. It's ajicitos, which is, they're like small peppers, but they're not hot, they're sweet. And then green peppers, onion, garlic, green olives, cilantro, and culantro, which is not cilantro. It's also called racao, but it's not leafy like cilantro. It looks more like a longer leaf plant, but it gives, you know, flavor to the sofrito. So that's on day one. And then on day two, you assemble everything, so you get your parchment paper, and then on top of that, you lay out your banana leaf. And then you put achote, which is like it's lard with a little bit of food coloring, so you can see, you know, where it is on the leaf. And then you lay out a spoonful of the masa, the paste that you made the day before, and then the filling. You kind of wrap it up like a little business envelope, and then you tie it with a string. And then you can either freeze them or you boil them for about an hour. And then when we make them for Thanksgiving, we make, I don't know, 100. Like, it has to last you throughout Three Kings Day. Uh-huh. So, yeah, you make a lot. So, the whole family comes in from, you know, out of town, wherever they've been, and it's an assembly line.
Is it a one-time-a-year thing? Does it only happen on Thanksgiving?
Yes, yeah.
And so do you still do this? Is this a family tradition?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And so you go out to Connecticut and do this on Thanksgiving?
No, where? My mom is back in the city.
Oh, she's back in the city.
She's back in Hell's Kitchen.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So we go up there and she's in, you know, back in Hell's Kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And actually only recently was I, the chickpeas, you have to skin them. So skinning like all these chickpeas, that was my job for the longest time because it always fell to like a kid in the family. Only recently was I graduated to dicing green olives. And I mean dicing.
They just let you start doing
it? Yeah, they just let me touch the olives. So
that's great. You're like, I'm a professional baker at a 3-star restaurant. I can do a little bit more than this task.
Yeah, but I was like, can I do the meat? And they're like, no.
Wow. Got to work your way up to that.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that process. I'm here with Sheena Otto, who is now the head baker of Il Buco Alimentari in Manhattan. In her previous lives, she was an investigator. She worked on Wall Street. She had a brief run as a paralegal. When we return, we'll talk about her major big career change, how she started to bake, and how she ended up at Il Buco Alimentari. All that and more when we return to The Line. Stick with us.
And this one is called Relax, It's Just the End of the World by Tackstar. We'll be right back.
Chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
Welcome back to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman, and I am so happy to have Sheena Otto as my guest today. If you're just joining us, she's got a fascinating trajectory that has taken her from being an investigator at the CCRB, which is the Civilian Compliant Review Board. She worked at a law firm as a paralegal. She worked at a hedge fund, and after being laid off, she started to pursue a career as a baker. She is now the leader at one of New York City's most respected restaurant bakeries, Il Buco Alimentari. Before we talk about Il Buco, I know that you worked at Amy's and at Scratch. As far as I know, Amy's is like a pretty sizable brand name. They have a couple locations, and Scratch was a singular location that was in Bed-Stuy, right?
Correct.
It's no longer – he's been doing like pop-ups and stuff, but right. Scratch is no longer in Bed-Stuy,
right?
Unfortunately,
yeah.
And so I want you to talk a little bit about how each of those jobs benefited you, because as far as I could see in my research, they seem to be kind of polar opposites in the way that they operate as a bakery business model. If you could just talk a little bit about those differences.
Sure. Well, I guess when I before Amy's, I live in Bay Ridge, and I had been out of work for 6 months after being laid off, and there was like a Persian deli near me that was hiring counter staff. That's my first. It's called the Family Store, and that was my first job in food. And I started doing. I mean, I wasn't in the back cooking or anything, but I just loved the community vibe there. You know, they have been there for 20 years and all that. So. That was what kind of clinched it for me. And then Amy's, they were hiring overnight bakers, and her Hell's Kitchen location opened right where I grew up, on 47th and 9th, I was over on 11th Avenue, but, I went in there and I don't want to say I grew up with Amy's, but yeah, we grew up with Amy's, like everyone was really excited when she opened, and she's been there for 24 years, and I went in there and I said, I don't have any professional experience, but I will do anything. Like, I will do anything. I will come in here overnight. And when I was in college, I was a switchboard operator overnight. So I told him, I was like, I know how to work overnight. I know that you sleep at the same time every day and that you have to do this and you have to keep a schedule. And I was like, I literally begged them to please hire me. And Toy, who interviewed me, Toy was Amy's partner. She kind of recognized me. She was like, you look so familiar. And I was like, oh, well, we grew up here. My mom is still in the neighborhood. But I think, she recognized me from when I was, living there when you're like a kid or a teenager after my mom moved back and you go through those awkward years and you're like all dramatic and, you like complain about, oh, pink cake. I mean, it's delicious, but pink, Uh-huh. So that was a little embarrassing for a job interview. She was like, well, it's nice to see that you've matured. And I was like sweating. I was like, oh my God. But, yeah. So Amy's, got me in and I loved it there baking. I mean, even though it was overnight, we were doing all the pastry stuff. And then, when I was at Amy's doing five nights overnight in the pastry kitchen, I noticed that they were, the whole time my goal is to be a baker, maybe, I don't know, open a bakery someday or do whatever, that's the end goal. And I noticed how much bread they were selling. So I was like, oh, I should learn how to make bread. So I asked Toy if I could intern in the Chelsea Market location when they were still, had their production there. And then they let me. So for one day a week, daytime, which was a little hard, one day a week, I would intern in Chelsea Market. And then the other five nights, I would be in Hell's Kitchen. And then a spot opened up in Chelsea Market, and I again begged, and I was like, please.
Please let me be awake during the daytime.
Yeah, exactly. So I did that. And then I loved it there. I met some of my best friends there. And then they moved the whole operation, like pastry and bread. And as they were expanding, they're currently in Long Island City, mm-hmm. which, I live in Bay Ridge, and that's kind of far.
Totally.
So I started casually looking for a new job, and then that's how I ended up at Aterra. And then scratch bread, Aterra.
Don't skip over Aterra, yeah, please. For the listeners, let them know what Aterra is.
Okay.
I assume Matthew Leitner was the chef there when you worked there?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Okay, so yeah. So Aterra is a 2 Michelin star restaurant in Tribeca, opened by Chef Leitner. They were super focused on, it was only 18 seats, tasting menu. Before, tasting menus were really popular.
Totally.
In the city back in, I believe we opened in March 2012. They hired me in the summer of 2011, and he was like, yeah, we're going to open in October of 2011. And I was like, look, I'm from the city. Like, I know, how many permits you need and like how
right.
construction goes. And I was like, you are not opening in, but whatever. Yes, chef. Right. And he wanted me I applied for like the head baker position, and I brought him some bread, and he, offered me the job right there.
Wow. And, awesome. So you brought him, what did you bring him?
I brought him a whole wheat sesame loaf, and just a regular white sourdough loaf, and then another white loaf studded with pancetta.
And he hired you right on the spot after he tasted the bread, basically?
He offered me the job, and then I was like, are you sure? Because I've only been doing this for a year, like an idiot, you know? like, really?
Just take the job.
Right? And he looked at me, and he was like, all right, well, think about it, but don't think about it too long. And yeah. I was like, oh, okay, sure. Anyway, I looked into what he had done in Portland, and they had someone compared him to Per Se, and like I had never heard of Per Se, which I know sounds insane, but and then I looked at the Per Se menu and I was like, I can't do this. Oh my God. You know, this is a $300 tasting menu. I can't. So that's how I came to Scratch Bread. Before, so I was still at Amy's and also starting to work on recipes for Atera, but I was like, I need to learn how to do small batches now, like yesterday. I need to do this. Mm-hmm. So I started researching like what bakeries are small artisanal style bakeries that like could show me, you know, where I could learn how to do start to finish. Cause Amy's is quite a large production. It's artisanal style, but you know, they have a team of mixers and a team of shapers and a team of bakers.
Does it have a wholesale operation outside of the Amy's location as well?
Everything has been condensed into the Long Island City.
Okay.
Like she brought everything.
That's a massive operation. Though.
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, I didn't think I would be able to get the knowledge I needed for an 18 seat restaurant from Amy's, was just delivering bread to like all over the metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. So, Matt Tilden, the owner of Scratch Bread, was running an intern program. So I emailed him and I said, hey, you know, and I told him I wanted to learn more about small batch baking. And yeah, I went there for 3 months and that's how I started at Scratch Bread.
And Scratch was doing some pretty interesting things, right? Mm-hmm. So they were doing some, I mean, can you speak to some of the sourcing? Were they grinding? Were they sourcing certain flours that were kind of unique blends or something? I don't know exactly, but if you can tell the listeners specifically what was going on at Scratch.
When I was there, they were working a lot, maybe primarily with Cayuga flours, which is farmer ground flours upstate New York. And they do a lot of, they have their own farm. They do a lot of small batch milling. And so those were the, like, it was that purveyor that he was working mainly with. Mm-hmm. And everything, you know, was hand-shaped. He had, like, a sourdough bread that was fermented for something like, I want to say 72 hours, which is a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, cold fermentation, so that you really get, like, that nice flavor, like, that, you know, that sour, you know, kick that you, like, kind of want in, like, a good bread. And the keeping quality was amazing. And, but that's, yeah, I mean, I was only there for 3 months. I know there was Cayuga flours there. If he eventually moved into milling his own flour, I don't think it was when I was there.
Okay. So you go to both these places, mm-hmm. you learn a ton at both of them. Mm-hmm. Then you jump back to Atera. Mm-hmm. What was your contribution like to Atera in terms of baking? Were you doing breads for the start of the meal? How did it incorporate it in the tasting menu? Were you doing sweet as well? Were you doing savory breads? What were you doing at Atera?
It was a 22 course tasting menu. I was doing about probably 10 breads a day. Three of the breads would be like part of the tasting menu, and they had their own cultured butter that they would serve with it. And then after the opening of the restaurant upstairs, they opened the Atera Lounge in the basement, which mm-hmm. was a kind of a more casual place. You could get drinks and a burger. And fries, and I did the buns for that. I didn't do any desserts. It was just literally just they had their own bread program. So probably the most famous bread that I made there was the pork fat roll, mm-hmm. which was a sourdough roll, and it was basted in pork fat. And it was I came up with it because Chef Leitner asked me. He said, oh, so I want a roll that you don't want to butter. And I was like, well, I don't know what that means. He says, I want a roll that you don't want to put butter on. And then he leaves. And I was like, So I was like, all right, well, so it has to have some kind of fat in it already. I was like, oh, we got this lard laying around. Let's see what happens.
Awesome. So how long did you stay at Atera? And then when did you decide to move on to being Cui?
I was at Aterra for about 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And so I worked a little bit with Chef Ronnie Emborg when he came on. And I kind of, like, at the three-year mark, I was kind of like, this is great and everything, but I really missed working in a bakery. I mean, it was, you know, it's a restaurant kitchen. I just kind of wanted to get back to, like, a larger production. Not like a monster production, but just something a little more than, you know, 24 rolls for dinner service. It seemed like a good time to transition when they were, like, transitioning chefs, since, like, the whole menu was going to change anyway and stuff like that. So Biancui was hiring, and I, you know, I applied, and I went in for an interview and everything, and that's when I became the sous chef at Biancui.
I have gone to Biancui a lot because I used to work on Hoyt Street, which is one block over, and there is this miche loaf that they have, which, like, haunts my dreams. I'm so sad that I don't really get to have that every single day. But I'm a huge fan of just eating bread by itself, mm-hmm. which I, maybe you don't think that's weird, but I think a lot of people see me eating just a baguette plain and they think that that is weird. But for me, the flavors of the bread is enough. When you are thinking about a new bread that you're going to be working on, do you think of it as a standalone item or do you think of it as a more of like a composite of how people will use the bread? Like, do you think this bread is good enough to eat by itself? Or are you always thinking about how someone is going to utilize it for like a sandwich or whatever they might use it for?
Both, honestly. At Aterra, it would, you know, a lot of times they would tell me we need this for a dish. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I might lower the salt a little bit, you know, if I knew it was going to be like have some kind of salty topping. But right now I make it as a standalone bread. But if it's meant to be, you know, if it's a loaf that's a sandwich loaf, I don't want to have like an overpowering flavor of, you know, some add-in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't add like a ton of, I don't know, fennel seeds, for mm-hmm. example. If it was meant to be a sandwich loaf. But I think mostly as a standalone bread, because I eat bread plain also, you know, mm-hmm. like I just, yeah, someone will put a little olive oil or butter in front of me and I'm like, I'm good.
I'm not really a potato chip or a cracker person, but I will eat a whole loaf of bread by myself, standing, sitting in front of the TV, whatever. What types of bread styles are you working with now at El Buco that are really exciting you? What flavors are you putting into the breads and what kind of flours are you working with at El Buco?
Well, we just recently started sourcing Anson Mills flours. We just started selling them for retail, and we're actually the only place in New York City that is retailing Anson Mills grains. But I guess I'm making a buckwheat rye right now. It's a 1.5 kilo loaf. It's a freeform boule, which is just like a round loaf, and I like that one because it's just, you know, there's only, you know, buckwheat and rye and, you know, some flour, you know, and yeast, not yeast, I'm sorry, it's naturally fermented, but like salt and water. And just when you get these amazing grains like that and you can just add, you know, water and salt to them, and then you just get the natural flavor of the grain, that's exciting to me. So I'm kind of moving back to, the whole philosophy of El Buco is to just, if you're going to pay all this attention to your product, you know, we're going to shape it by hand and we're going to use, you know, this long fermentation, like you might as well use the best ingredients. So mm-hmm. coming back to that is really exciting. We are also starting to source some Italian flowers like from Sicily, which is pretty amazing too.
I love the chemistry of baking. It seems like such a confusing process to someone who doesn't bake, perhaps to someone who's been baking professionally as well. There is so much that goes into a loaf of bread. I find it to be a lot more confusing than cooking a protein or working with vegetables. There's so much about temperature and storage. Can you speak a little bit about natural fermentation for the listeners that are just totally unclear of what that means in reference to making a more standardized bread loaf that uses yeast, where you're getting just like a traditional rise out of it?
Well, so natural fermentation is when you start a sourdough culture from flour and water. And just the like yeast lives everywhere. It's on the table. It's on us. It's alive in nature, and so you kind of cultivate it from the wheat grains that you get, and after hopefully if nothing horrible happens, like a bacteria contaminates it, after about 2 weeks you'll have a viable sourdough starter, and this provides like a flavor. To the bread, and there's a lot of chemical reactions in there going on that I don't, I'm embarrassed to say I don't fully understand. It's been around for 6,000 years, so I'll probably never fully understand.
Right, but that's actually part of the kind of exciting part, is that you can't actually maybe really ever understand it.
But I guess to compare it to commercial yeast, you get the same. Obviously, commercial yeast will leaven a loaf of bread, but the flavor, the complexity of the flavors are not there. There's not like the same amount of, acids and bacteria forming from a naturally fermented loaf than with like a yeasted loaf. I'm not sure if that answers your question or.
Totally, yeah. Okay. You have had many different jobs. You seem to have a sort of laser focus when you want to do something. It seems like you go after it and you get it. Do you feel like you found your home in baking?
I think so. Yeah. I love it. I love it. And you kind of have to love it because the hours are crazy and it takes a toll on your body, but it's a labor of love. Even if you're having, a bad day or, it's not like, something happens in the kitchen or whatever. Once the loaves come out of the oven and you smell that aroma and, you bite into it or you have that first slice, it makes it all worth it. So yeah, once I started baking, I've never doubted it, in the other jobs.
You said that, I know that you start at 3 a.m. So you mentioned earlier before we went on that, it's sort of a solitary life. You said that you want to get dinner with your friends and a late dinner for you is 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon. I love that moment when I get to the kitchen early before everyone else. Mm-hmm. I turn on the lights, you turn on the oven, mm-hmm. kind of like the master of the room. But for me, other people show up at a certain point. And for you, really, it's you and really only one other person. And you said on that person's day off, you're all by yourself.
Right.
Is that a part of the job that you love? That sort of solitary, it's only on you?
It can be good and bad. I definitely like having, being able to hear my own thoughts and get my things together and work at, knowing that if I'm in charge of everything so that, I can set my own schedule and, set my own pace and do what needs to be done. And people start arriving, later in the morning also. But also, the negatives to it is that, it is, kind of like you kind of get off work when people are still working. It is kind of a solitary life. And you miss your friends when, they're out at dinner without you. You want to do something later at night and you kind of have to think about let me see if I can take a nap here and then, try to wake up. But it's definitely got its pluses and minuses. But I think overall the good definitely outweighs any minor inconvenience.
It's a true labor of love in order to be in that kitchen baking bread. Sheena, thank you so much for joining us. This was so awesome to hear your story. Everyone listening out there, you can go to Il Buco Alimentari or Il Buco to taste her great breads. And if you feel like it, she's there at 3 a.m. You can you can find her there working all the time. But please drop by her restaurant and check out some of her wonderful breads that she's baking. Thanks again for being with us. And thank you for joining us on this episode of The Line every Tuesday on Heritage Radio at 11 a.m.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.